Tonight we begin to talk about revolution and revival. Sort of mark the 18th century in lots of different ways. Of course, the story of our country as we know it begins with a quest for religious liberty. I believe that one of the most important contributions that Baptists have made to this country is our advocacy and support of religious liberty. So the early pilgrims came and they began the process of founding new colonies. And so the Massachusetts Bay Colony was, by its very nature, a Puritan experiment. And thus, there were religious requirements for being a part of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And you can see, as you read in your book, the way that over time, compromises had to be made because not everybody's children became Christians, and so they needed a place to live. Maybe one of the most important developments was when a man named Roger Williams came, and he was rejected the requirement of licensure to preach. He didn't believe that the government should be able to say who can and cannot preach, and so he then left, eventually exiled from Massachusetts Bay Colony and founded a town called Providence that we now know as Providence, Rhode Island. And Williams kind of bounced around religiously, but for a while he was a Baptist and at that time founded essentially the first Baptist church in America in Providence, Rhode Island. So part of what Williams was passionate about in going to Providence was creating a place where people could freely practice religion, where multiple denominations could practice religion. So maybe it's worth taking just a moment to talk about why Baptists are passionate about religious liberty. One reason why Baptists in America in particular, and our forebears that were Baptists in Britain also, were passionate about religious liberty is because they were persecuted early on for the preaching of the gospel, for being nonconformists, so to speak. So in Britain, the fact they weren't Church of England led to persecution. And then in the United States, in the colonies, you had a situation where in predominantly Church of England states, there was a requirement to get a license to preach. You couldn't go preach without a license from the state. Now think about that for a second. This sounds crazy to us, doesn't it? I don't think anyone here, and maybe that just shows you how Baptist we are, I don't think anyone here wants me to have to go to the courthouse to get a license to preach. You know what I mean? We believe in licensing to preach through the local church. And even then, you don't have to have a license to preach, right? We don't require that. I don't ever call someone and say, hey, I want you to come preach for me, but I'm going to need you to bring your license with you, you know, to make sure you can. No, we don't really do it that way. But the reality is Baptists are passionate about religious liberty, passionate about religious freedom, because Baptists want to be able to preach the gospel freely. And so this is one of the reasons why I'm so grateful that religious liberty is one of the foundational principles of America. And you can see this happening prominently through the advocacy of Baptists and other religions as well, but other denominations as well. But for example, Thomas Jefferson, in his infamous letter that talks about a wall of separation between church and state, in that letter, it was actually a letter he wrote to a group of Baptists who were worried about religious liberty in the new country. So he was making sure it was clear that the new country, the founding country, would not regulate religion in the way that the colonies had. So I'll just say, I believe, personally, that religious liberty is the ideal Christian situation in a fallen world. Now, obviously, ideally, everyone would be Christians, and we would be able to have good Christian leadership exclusively, and everyone would obey Jesus perfectly, and things would go as they would. But we don't have that. It's just not the world we live in. And so the option of being able to worship as we choose, I think, is a great blessing. And let me just tell you why. It's because I believe in the priesthood of every believer. Okay? The priesthood of every believer is one of the most foundational Baptist principles. It's a biblical principle, but we highlight it in unique ways. This is the reason why our churches are autonomous. Okay? This is why, like, tomorrow, if we wanted to, change our name to Furman Baptist Church, we could. We could vote to do that. Nobody would care. You know, Larry Furman Baptist Church, we could do that. And please don't make a motion, anybody. But anyway, that's right, yeah. And if we wanted to do that, we could. And nobody could stop us, right? We could just vote to do that because this is our church. If we wanted to sell our property, we can sell our property. If we want to buy a van, sell a van, you know, any of those kinds of things we can do. We don't have to call a bishop or any of those kinds of things. We have autonomy as a local church. We want to amend our statement of faith. How we want to do that? We want to do that. Now, we can be deemed not in friendly cooperation by any of the Baptist bodies of which we're a part. So our local association, our Alabama Baptist Convention, or the National Baptist Convention could say, okay, you've changed your statement of beliefs where you no longer worship Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Let's just say, I'm just thinking of something outlandish we would never do. And they could just say, you know, you don't believe that anymore. You're no longer a church of like faith and practice with the rest of our churches. And so we could be deemed not in friendly cooperation. But all that means is we're just no longer in friendly cooperation with those churches. We basically just lose our right to cooperate and lose those privileges of cooperation. But besides that, we keep our building. We keep whatever we want to do. Now, we lose our lampstand, you know, if we abandon the gospel, which I'd rather have than anything, you know. But all that being said, we're able to do that because Baptists believe in the priesthood of every believer, and that each individual conscience is responsible for itself. Each person is responsible for him or herself before God. And so, if you take that principle is also very important for our understanding of religious liberty and the early colonists' understanding of religious liberty, because nobody will be with you at the judgment day, right? Like, nobody will be there at the judgment day. No government official, no president, no senator, no governor, no mayor. Nobody will be with you at the judgment day. So if you are coerced into belief by the state can't regulate true worship. The state can't create true worship. Only the gospel can do that. And that individual will then stand before God to answer for this life. And so, therefore, each person, we would say, ought to be able to worship God as they see fit. Now, as Christians, we know, we believe, everyone ought to worship God by grace through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the only way to truly know God. But listen, I'll just say this. If you just take all the ideas that have ever existed in the world and you throw them out there and you throw the gospel out there and somebody says, are you going to take the gospel or are you going to take the field on what's going to emerge victorious in the end? You give me the preaching of the gospel every day. So I think for the preaching of the Christian gospel, there's no better context than a state where there is religious liberty, religious freedom. I think it's a good thing. So I advocate for it personally and believe in it. And I think it's a significant contribution that Baptists made in the founding of America. But let me just say, there's the flip side of religious freedom and religious liberty is that sometimes things can get a little weird, right? And so you have this story in here about a lady who, nothing wrong with this, she starts a Bible study in her house. And next thing you know, things just, and this is really what I mean by this, things just get a little bit weird with a lady named Ann Hutchinson. And she winds up getting excommunicated from the Massachusetts Bay Colony and moves to Providence as well. And during this time as well, you have something that I wouldn't say is a little weird, but was wrong-headed at best, that has become a little bit of one of those things that I think people overstate and overreact to in the modern age, and I'm not trying to justify it at all, but the Salem witch trials, some people talk about all the time as this great failure of Christianity, and it was that. But I think it might be time to get some new examples. I'll just put it like that. You know, people just want to talk about the Salem witch trials all the time. Like, what about the Inquisition? What about the Salem witch trials? The Salem witch trials happen. I mentioned this earlier in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. There's something to learn here. The next generation of colonists, the colonists' children, I think Jones says about half of them proclaimed faith in Jesus, claimed to be converted. And so the kids are not all right. You know what I mean? And I don't know if you guys have noticed this. I bet you have. Have y'all noticed how everyone tends to panic about the whatever the next generation is? Has anybody noticed this? All right. I am now no longer the next generation. Okay? I am now, as of November 6th, I will be 38 years old. I am, nobody's looking at, you know, a 38-year-old pastor in North Alabama, pastor of a Southern Baptist church with three kids and a mortgage, and thinking like, there, here comes the revolution. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's like, I'm now officially boring and middle-aged. So I am now, I can just say, I've for a long time been one of those. I'm a millennial, and so I've always been, you know, you always hear about these millennials are coming along and they're doing this and doing that or whatever. But now I'm loving this because I can complain about Gen Y with everybody else. Like, everybody, they're terrible, TikTok's so dumb. And 5 years ago I looked at Whitney and said, I don't know if TikTok is dumb or if I'm old. And I think it's both now, the longer I'm around. But anyway, I just say, we always are like, I just don't know what's going to happen. I'll just tell you, I do the same thing sometimes. I just don't know what's going to happen with this next generation, you know? Even with my own kids sometimes. Ford the other day, his job at the house is to take the trash out and take the trash cans to the road and bring them back. So the other day, I came home a couple days in a row, and I just noticed, it didn't dawn on me till, you know, a couple days after the trash had been picked up, the trash cans are still at the road. And I came in and I said, hey, 40, I think it's time to bring the trash cans up. And he said, oh, no, Dad, I've got a great plan. And I was like, let's hear it. He said, I'm just going to leave them down there and take the trash down there so that we don't have to bring them back and forth. And I said, you know, Ford, that's a great idea. But we're not doing that. That's not how it works. You know what I mean? I don't want a note from the neighbors. Like, we're not going to, you're going to take it up. He's like, it just makes sense though, you know? And then the other night, I said, all right, Ford, it was almost bath time. I said, Ford, you've not got the trash cans. You need to get the trash cans. And he said, Dad, he just kept delaying. Finally, I was like, Ford, go get the trash cans. He said, I was trying to do it right before my bath so I didn't have to wash my hands. Feels redundant. And, I just don't know about the next generation, guys. I just don't know what we're gonna do. And if you know Ford at all, it's just the most Ford stories you can imagine. And they're not very unlike Matt Alexander at 10 years old. So, all that being said, we're all sort of nervous about the next generation. So, at this time, what you have happening is with religion waning in these Puritan communities in what we now know as New England, you have a sort of fervor and worry and fear that starts to get whipped up. And as that starts to kind of hit a fever pitch, you have someone get accused of practicing magic, dabbling in the occult. And that kind of pent-up frustration gets unleashed on women during this era. And on a group of women, and it kind of turns into a little bit of hysteria. And it's just a reminder that good decisions are never made out of fear. They're never made out of worry. It's just rare, and we can wind up making big mistakes that actually cost us in the long run rather than help us in the long run when we're worried and afraid all the time. So I think that's one thing maybe we can learn from the witch trials and maybe from the Anne Hutchinson episode that trying to control people's hearts is impossible. Okay? This is something I've had to learn as a pastor. You know? You're an unwieldy bunch. All right? And all the time, I'll just, you know, just get a little hint of somebody doing something that I just think, you know, I don't know if that's what you should do. Right? And as a pastor, what would your temptation be? Well, there's all kinds of ways to do it. The passive-aggressive ones, just preach on that the next Sunday. You know what I mean? And And which is like the classic, I think it's just such a bad managerial move, you know, addressing the whole group for the problems that one person had. So I'm not going to do that. And plus, I'm an expository preacher, so it would be really obvious if I slipped your sin in there. You know what I mean? Like, what does that have to do with this? I think he's preaching to me. He is, I promise, you know. And so you don't do that. But then I think a lot of pastors tend to want to kind of over-pastor. I'm going to go, and immediately, as soon as they hear somebody doing something, I'm not talking about some major, major sin that's clearly something that's it's a violation of our fellowship and something that's going to bring shame and ill repute on the name of Jesus. I don't mean something like that. That's a different scenario. But I mean, there's things kind of in the middle, you know? And pastors want to kind of jump out there and start to kind of control the situation. And somewhere in my life, it finally dawned on me. I really believe that the Word and the Spirit will do a better job with everybody's souls than Matt Alexander will. Several years ago, we had a situation develop on Christmas Eve. And y'all know Christmas Eve is a big service for us, probably the biggest, best attended service of the year. It's a big thing, and it's on Christmas Eve. So that just kind of adds to the pressure and challenges for us as a staff. It can just kind of be hard because we're trying to do things with our family, and then you come, and then you have this huge service, and it's a hard day to balance everything. That's not a complaint. We love Christmas Eve in our family, but it can be a hard thing. So y'all probably know this, but we go to Waffle House on Christmas Eve after the Christmas Eve service. Classy food for classy people. And so we go to Waffle House on Christmas Eve, and it's about where we belong. And me, at least, not Whitney. But we go to Waffle House, and so this particular year, somebody, well-meaning, had locked the main doors, the sanctuary, too early. They were meant to be locked like 10 minutes after the service started. This person locked them like 10 minutes before the service started. The big main doors at the top of the steps. So I don't know if you guys know what happens when people are excited about going to church and they come to a locked door at the top of the tallest staircase in America. They leave, you know what I mean? Or they catch their breath and call somebody. And so it was just a disaster. So as the night progressed, more and more people were getting reports. And so, of course, by God's grace, they call me and let me know. So I'm, you know, 3/4 through the way of an all-star special with like 18 text messages and people saying, "Hey, Pastor, I know there's nothing you can do about it. I just want to let you know in the future. You might want to call these people. They got locked out of church tonight." Beside you, and I was like, okay, great. So I'm just kind of like, okay, fine. It's Christmas Eve. I get through it. Everything's fine. Everything works out. Some of the people that, I don't know, we might have lost a prospect forever. I don't know. But most of the people for whom it happened, they laughed about it. Explained it later. It's fine. Well, then Sunday rolls around several days after, and I'm at max saturation on talking about these doors. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just maxed out on it. And, let me say this. Please tell me things. I would rather hear it twice than zero times, okay? So don't mishear me. But I'm maxed out on talking about these doors. And so a sweet person comes up to me. Well, they're not that sweet, but I love them. And they come up to me they say, really, it was a well-meaning thing. They weren't complaining or anything. They said, I don't know if you know this, but the doors got locked on early on Christmas Eve. I'm not sure if you've heard. And I was like, you know, I have heard. And, God, I know. And I said, and I'm so sorry, but I just can't control everything that happens around here. You know, and they, like I said, this was all in good faith. And they just said, well, of course, I know, Pastor. We know you can't control everything. I mean, it's fine. I just want to make sure you knew. And I was like, because if I could, things would be a lot worse than they are. In other words, I trust the Word and the Spirit, right? To straighten this place out a lot better than me. If I lived all your lives for you, this church would not be as good as it is, okay? If I made every decision here, this church would not be as good as it is. And so I think that's one of the lessons we can learn, maybe in the midst of these witch trials and the Ann Hutchinson situation, that our desire to control, right? Our desire to keep everything lined up perfectly. And maybe some of us can think about this. I think about this with my own children sometimes, my family, just all kinds of things, like wanting to make decisions for everybody. And but the Word and the Spirit, God is able to do more with people and better with people than their pastors can. And then that the Board of Elders at the Massachusetts Bay Colony can do. And you can see the way that desire for control, that desire to keep things perfect, apart from the Word and the Spirit, right? Through the machinations, the workings of man, is still a black eye in Christian history. Okay, around this time, I think I told y'all this a few weeks ago, I have been, my brain's fried sometimes, and I got the Enlightenment and the Renaissance mixed up. My terms. So now we're actually talking about the Enlightenment during this time. 18th century a movement develops known as the Enlightenment. And out of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, one of the reasons why my brain stores those together is they were similar in some ways. These were both retrievals of learning, commitments to learning, but the Enlightenment is different. Because what the Enlightenment seeks to do, it's an experiment that tries to elevate human reason over any other faculty, any other thought process, any other desire. And so you can understand then the way that this elevation of reason then tended to seek to downplay the role of faith and what we can't understand. Now, we're actually sort of smack dab in the middle of a reckoning on the Enlightenment. Right now, we're really living through that. The Enlightenment is essentially what we would call the thought process of modernism, right? In the early 1900s, you begin to have a thought process develop or a movement of thinking develop called postmodern thinking. Postmodernism that gives rise to a sort of relativism. And now we're sort of at post whatever that is. I don't want to say postmodernism, but really even postmodernism has kind of fallen apart. And what you have developing right now is a sort of spirituality and seeking and revolt against modernism and the surety of modernism and the surety of the Enlightenment and the praise of pure reason. And you begin to have just sort of everybody kind of throwing up their shoulders and saying, I don't know. I don't think we have it as clear as we thought. Now, probably the thing that busted the bubble of the Enlightenment more than anything else. Anybody have a guess? Anybody want to guess? Really, two things. Numbers one and two. World Wars. World War I and maybe especially World War II probably did more than anything to bust the bubble of the Enlightenment. This pure reason is all we need. If we could just become purely reasonable, then the world would become basically a utopia. We would get rid of all the dogma. We would get rid of all the superstition. And everybody would become modern, good thinkers. Now, and we'll use technology to become great. Which somebody took a lot of those ideas and used them, but they used them to try to take over the world, right? Adolf Hitler, who leveraged probably the greatest technological civilization in the world at the time, certainly what became the greatest military in the world at the time. Whitney and I, a few weeks ago, I think I told you all this, we went to the World War II Museum, and I was just stunned afresh to be reminded of how small the U.S. military was on the world stage at the outset of World War II. And you had a real isolationist approach in America at that point, a small military. And so you have this guy who uses technology in an enlightened Western nation to commit some of the worst atrocities in human history, right? And so this idea that we can just become purely reasonable creatures kind of gets blown up when so many people died in World War I and World War II on the other end of technological advance, really. So the Enlightenment comes, and during this time, you also have huge, though, what's beneficial during the season are the huge discoveries and strides that are taken in science, in the world of science. I think it's important to remember that most of the Enlightenment scientists were Christians and came from a Christian worldview, like, for example, Sir Isaac Newton, who developed the theory of gravity during this time. And so when we look at the Enlightenment, especially as Christians, sometimes we tend to almost look at it as an entirely bad thing. But there is a sense in which there are many, many good things that came from the Enlightenment, and things for which we can be grateful. There's another sort of religious understanding. How do I say this? there's a understanding of God that develops during this time that we now call deism. As opposed to what we would call ourselves, which is as far as our understanding of who God is, we are theists. We believe that there is a God and that He is personal. There's some level of a personality to God, and that's what a theist would believe, and that God is at some level active in the world. Essentially, basic what we call theism. Deism is a stripping down of belief in a divine power around principles of enlightenment. And some of our founding fathers were kind of infamously deists. But deism is the idea that seemingly there was someone or something that made the world, right? But that more than likely this being created the world but is no longer active in it. Okay, so that's a disavowal of miracles or any of the sorts of things that indicate the activity of God in the world that would be hard for someone who's purely reasonable to believe. So, for example, if you claim to be a good Enlightenment thinker, miracles, and we've all sort of, or well, I should maybe say this. Some of you guys may not have been raised in the same milieu as me, but even me, from a small town in North Alabama, I have been kind of raised, even though I was raised in church and a lot of my teachers were Christians and everything else, I went to a Baptist college. Nonetheless, the sort of milieu around me, right, the just sort of worldview around me tended to see miracles as things that were just sort of impossible to believe, almost laughable. Well, of course, those things didn't really happen. I worked with a guy in Louisville when I was in secular work while I was in seminary who would just grill me on like Bible story after Bible story. You know, he'd be like, so you really believe, I mean, like, you know, you really believe that Jonah got swallowed up by a great fish? You really believe that? I'd be like, yeah, I do, you know, I really do. And then, you know, later, he'd be like, you really believe in the virgin birth? You really believe in this, really believe in that? Finally, I was like, man, that's not even the hardest verse in the Bible to believe. I mean, the hardest verse in the Bible to believe is in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If you can swallow that, the rest is gravy, I feel like. You know what I mean? That's the hardest thing. The most offensive verse in the Bible is in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Everything that you find distasteful in the Bible, and y'all can be honest here, some of you somewhere have read something in the Bible and thought, ugh, this just didn't quite go down right. Okay? All those things really hang off of that central truth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so finally, you just say, listen, if there is a God and He created the world, I don't have a problem believing that He's active in it. And any idea, any notion of a miracle is entirely predicated on the fact there is a God. And so to me, it is no less reasonable to believe that God is active in the world than it is to believe that God created the world. In fact, I think it's a much bigger jump of reason to believe in a creator God than it is to believe in a God that's active in the world. Nonetheless, all that being said, that's one of the things that I find foolish about the sort of deist approach, is that to me, it's harder to believe and it makes less sense to believe in a God who fine-tuned the universe and set it in motion and disappeared. That's harder for me to believe in than it is a God who's active in human history. A God of providence, a sovereign God who's active. And again, to me, the like, do you really believe in miracles to this moment is just philosophically, theologically, at every level, kind of the silliest question I get asked by skeptics. Now, I don't mean to say that if you read a miracle and you're like, man, that's just fantastical, that's strange. What I like to answer to that is, that's why it's a miracle, right? I mean, you can kind of see the fingerprints of something supernatural happening. When people try to explain miracles away as natural phenomenon or whatever else like that, everything that has happened by the hand of God and the Christian understanding of providence. And so I don't feel this need to... So in other words, I mean, if that's the case, then if it's just the Red Sea, is actually the Reed Sea, and it's this much water, and every once in a while, you know, this phenomenon happens, and all this kind of thing. I mean, that kind of thing to me doesn't really do anything for Christianity. And I do think, though, that what you have is a lot of these arguments developed in early stage Enlightenment thinking, when the theories were still really fresh and people really still thought that the universe was just super fine-tuned and that there were no ghosts in the machine and that there were no hard questions to answer, that everything had a practical answer. But the longer we're at this and the longer we live in a post-Enlightenment world, as I've said earlier, the more often those bubbles tend to get popped, right? And I don't know. I just have a hard time looking at the world and thinking that random chance and occurrence makes more sense than an unmoved mover of some sort, a creator of some sort. So you have that occurring. Deism, then, for example, is exemplified by the Jeffersonian Bible, if you're familiar with this at all. But Jefferson edited a Bible that he thought would be more appealing to Enlightenment minds, and he basically took all the miracles out, anything that he thought people would be offended by, and it wound up being extremely short, in case you didn't know, because the Bible is a record of the acts and works of God, which by their very nature are miraculous, right? By their very nature. Okay, but while the Enlightenment is happening, that's not the only thing that happens. You also have during this time a great, essentially worldwide, or at least in the United States and over in Britain, revival that happens that we now call the First Great Awakening. First Great Awakening. So it happens here and overseas as well. And out of this, a lot of movements develop from the Great Awakening. One of the earliest figures in what we now call the Great Awakening was a pastor in New England named Jonathan Edwards, who preached, and we'll talk about Edwards a little bit more now in a moment. But another movement that developed out of the Great Awakening was what we would call Pietism, the Pietism movement. And Pietism is a movement that represented passionate moral reform and revival in the Christian church, and passionate revival of personal spiritual disciplines in the Christian church. So Pietism and Pietists tended to, okay, this is a sweeping statement, all right, everybody, but tended to downplay doctrine, downplay theology, and play up personal experience, personal holiness, okay? That might be a little bit of an oversimplification, but goodness gracious, it's an 11-week Wednesday night church history course. What do you expect besides oversimplifications? Come on, guys. And so so Pietism tended to emphasize, I might even go as far as say, emphasize the experience of the heart at the expense of knowledge and theology and doctrine. And so, one famous Pietist is a guy named Count Zinzendorf. Count Zinzendorf became a leader in the Pietist movement over time, and he encountered a group of people that we now call the Moravians, and who were some of the earliest proponents of what we now call the modern missions movement. Some of the people who helped create the modern, were passionate about missions and the missions movement. Count Zinzendorf joined the Moravians in 1727, and his Pietism infused the Moravians with a passion for prayer. These are good things. Let me just say, I am thankful for Pietistic movements, and Baptist tradition has been greatly influenced by Pietistic movements. But I think, as we'll see over time, movements of the heart that aren't also movements of the head, or movements of the head that aren't also movements of the heart, tend to spiral out in bad direction. Well, movements of the head don't tend to spiral out. They tend to rust out. They tend to gum up and die. And then movements of the heart tend to spiral out of control. There's no ballast in the ship, so to speak. And so we might talk a little bit about some of those challenges. I'll tell you this, Pietistic movements are often very susceptible to theological liberalism, which we'll talk about next week. Theological liberalism, classical theological liberalism. So let me just say, we use terms in our modern political parlance, conservative and liberal. Just kind of, this is not what I mean by theological liberalism. We're not talking about modern politics. Classical theological liberalism, like I said, we'll talk about it a little bit more in detail, but essentially this was a movement that as the Enlightenment began to take hold in the West, people began to realize that, hey, we think we're not going to have any Christians left before too long. So we got to find a way to present Christianity to enlightened people. So what do? They said, well, what doesn't really matter is whether this stuff actually happened or not. What matters is that the apostles believed that it happened, and that got them through the day. And so pietistic movements, as you can tell, may have become a little more susceptible to theological liberalism over time because they are more focused on the subjective experience of Christ, right, than they are on the objective reality of what Christ has done, the doctrine, so to speak, the theology, so to speak. And so something like liberalism comes along and they can just say something like, what matters is not all this theological mumbo jumbo. What matters is how long our quiet times are, if we all love Jesus, and if we're doing something good for the Lord. Well, over time, though, that can corrode your theology to where you no longer even really believe in the Lord, right? So pietistic movements become a little more open to that over time. As part of the Great Awakening and another pietistic movement that develops during this time is the Wesleyan movement. So during this time, John and Charles Wesley are Church of England pastors who become Christians in the midst of the Great Awakening. And they begin to develop a sort of rule of life for those who want to follow them. And they become known for these methods of following Jesus. And so they get this moniker, Methodism. And so I'll say, I am so thankful for John and Charles Wesley. I'm so thankful for the history of Methodism and what Methodism has meant, really, if nothing else, for the spread of Christianity in North America. You can see the way that North America was evangelized by Wesleyan circuit riders and others, passionate about walking closely with Jesus, passionate about evangelism. But the Wesleys, and therefore the Wesleyan tradition, historically was nestled within the Church of England, right? So it was not a movement that developed out of theological concerns. It was a pietistic movement. It's about a personal walk with Jesus. And so, which isn't all bad. It's not a bad thing, but you don't have a unique theology that's contributed there, except to say that the Wesley brothers tended to lean more toward Arminianism, whereas their friend, George Whitefield, who was another prominent figure and prominent preacher, one of the greatest preachers ever lived, tended to lean a little more toward Calvinism in his preaching and teaching, to the point that it kind of caused a rift between them, but a friendly rift ultimately. In fact, I think it was Whitefield who was asked, do you think John or Charles, one of the Wesleys, do you think he'll be in heaven? This was probably a sophomore theology student who had read about Calvinism 6 weeks earlier and had decided, cage stage Calvinist comes up to him and asks him, these Arminians, you think they're going to be in heaven? No, he says, do you think you'll see John Wesley in heaven? Right? And so Whitefield says, no, I think he'll be so much closer to the throne of God than me that I won't be able to see him, you know? He's so much godlier than I am, which I love those sorts of answers. Let me give you one quote out of, I want to highlight a quote out of Jones here, because I love the little poem that Charles Wesley wrote. Some of my favorite hymns are Wesley hymns. And here's a little poem that Wesley wrote. Come, my Whitefield, the strife is past. And friends at first are friends at last. And friends are friends forever if the Lord's the Lord. No, I'm just kidding. He didn't write that. But anyway, you've got Wesley and the Whitefields, and you have the great fruit that the Lord bore through those pietist movements. At the same time, one man who is, I would argue, probably the greatest American theologian, Now, understand when I say greatest, I don't mean I agree with everything he says. I don't mean that he was necessarily the best thinker. Like, for example, I might call Karl Barth one of the greatest theologians who's ever lived, even though I disagree with a whole big swath of what Barth thought, right? There's all kinds of Aquinas is unquestionably one of the greatest theologians in Christian history, while I disagree with Aquinas on lots of things. But as far as American theologians go, there's almost no parallel to the brilliance of Jonathan Edwards. And Edwards was a Puritan. He was a pastor and was a huge factor that the Lord used in bringing about the First Great Awakening through his sermons. Let me ask y'all this. Does anybody know who I'm talking about when I talk about Jonathan Edwards? Anybody know about Edwards? All right. What do you think about when you think about Jonathan Edwards? Does anybody here ever, what? Yeah, sinners. Yeah, sinners in the hands of an angry God, right? Is that what everybody thinks about? Sinners in the hands of an angry God. You probably had to read it in high school. I remember, you know, it was like a Christian high school, and we had to read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And I remember just kind of being like, hey, I don't think that's all of us. I don't think this is what we preach like anymore, guys. Like, I kind of almost was like embarrassed a little bit. Let me encourage you at some point to read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Just see what you think about it. I mean, it really is a brilliant sermon. Is a sermon really ultimately calling people to salvation? Calling people to the grace of the Lord? It was said that Edwards' manuscript of all of his sermons, and I might encourage you sometime, not just Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, but any of Edwards' sermons, look them up and you read it, and it's like a term paper. It's very logically laid out. It's brilliant writing. They were extremely long, and he stood there. Let me back up. Scholars disagree on this, but most scholars think, and the consensus for a long time has been, even though there's new evidence that suggests that maybe he was more emphatic than this, but it's suggested that he read his sermon manuscript in a monotone voice. And so it's said that when he first preached Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God at a revival, that as he was reading in a monotone voice, reading this out, people were weeping and shouting in conviction, and that scores and scores of people were saved, and scores and scores and scores of people were saved under Jonathan Edwards' preaching. He wrote extensively on things like signs of true revival. And his preaching is really influential. I decided, instead of reading to you from Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, I decided to read to you from another sermon, another Jonathan Edwards sermon tonight, to give you another taste of the Puritans and another taste of Edwards. And I think, actually, even though Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was his most famous sermon, I actually think what I'm going to read to you tonight is actually more indicative of Edwards' thinking and more indicative of what he talked about the most. And the title of this sermon is Heaven, a World of Love, which sounds like a Joel Osteen sermon to you, doesn't it? Especially compared to Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. So I'm not going to read it all, and I'm not going to read it in a monotone voice. I'm not going to give you the full experience, but let me just read to you some of Edwards' sermon, Heaven, a World of Love, which, okay, a quick Google search will lead you to this, and I might encourage you, if you can get through some of the archaic language, to read it, because it is beautiful and helpful and good. Okay, the cause and fountain of love in heaven. Here, I remark that the God of love himself dwells in heaven. Heaven is the palace or presence chamber of the high and holy one, whose name is love, and who is both the cause and source of all holy love. God, considered with respect to his essence, is everywhere. He fills both heaven and earth, but yet he is said in some respects to be more especially in some places than in others. He was said of old to dwell in the land of Israel, above all other lands, and in Jerusalem, above all other cities. This is why I don't preach from a manuscript. I lose my place. Of that land. And in the temple, above all other buildings in the city. And in the Holy of Holies, above all other apartments of the temple. And on the mercy seat, over the Ark of the Covenant, above all other places in the Holy of Holies. But heaven is his dwelling place, above all other places in the universe. And all those places in which he was said to dwell of old were but types of this. Heaven is a part of creation that God has built for this end, to be the place of his glorious presence, and it is his abode forever. And here will he dwell and gloriously manifest himself to all eternity. And this renders heaven a world of love. For God is the fountain of love, as the sun is the fountain of light. And therefore the glorious presence of God in heaven fills heaven with love, as the sun, placed in the midst of the visible heavens in a clear day, fills the world with light. The apostle tells us that God is love. And therefore, seeing he is an infinite being, it follows that he is an infinite fountain of love. Seeing he is an all-sufficient being, it follows that he is a full and overflowing and inexhaustible fountain of love. And in that he is an unchangeable and eternal being, he is an unchangeable and eternal fountain of love. Okay. There's two sides to every coin. Remember that, guys. So you might think, whew, sinners in the hands of an angry God. I don't know about Jonathan Edwards. But just remember, heaven is a world of love. And Edwards goes on and on to talk about, I mean, he has this ability to take a thought or an idea or a verse and take it like a diamond or a prism and look at it from every single angle and show you every single way that it's impacted and go through it. Now, of course, if I preach for 2 or 3 hours, I might could do the same thing. But he's able to just really help you work through these issues. And as you can see, you can see the way he gives information. I just love just the clarity of his preaching. I was struck as I was reading this earlier today. I love this thought. I forget this sometimes, but it's an important reminder. Heaven is a part of creation that God made. You know, sometimes we think about heaven and we forget God made it. It's just a good thing to remind. I don't, maybe you guys think about that all the time. I just sometimes forget. It feels like heaven's always been, but it hasn't. God has always been, but heaven was made. Last thing. I love Edwards and I love his sermons, so y'all are getting a little dose of it. There, even in heaven, dwells the God from whom every stream of holy love, yea, every drop that is or ever was, proceeds. There dwells God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit, united as one, and infinitely dear, and incomprehensible, and mutual, and eternal love. Okay, I love this. I love him talking about the love in the Godhead. You can probably hear some of that influence coming out. In mind. One other thing I might encourage you to read at some point by Edwards, if you want to have the top of your theological brain blown off, okay, you might go read, you can Google it, an unpublished essay on the Trinity by Jonathan Edwards. It's probably the most brilliant thing I've ever read in my life. I think I've told you all the story. One of my favorite professors in seminary was an older gentleman named Tom Nettles. Tom Nettles wrote a book called Baptists in the Bible that really helped our convention of churches do some theological retrieval in the 70s, 80s, and 90s to kind of be reminded of the view that Baptists historically have held about the reliability of Scripture, the truthfulness of the Bible. One day, I took a class with Dr. Nettles called Jonathan Edwards. It's just a class on the life and thought of Edwards. And one day, he was lecturing to us on an unpublished essay on the Trinity. And this is one of those classes, I mean, typically if you take this class, you've already been to seminary a year or two, and if you go take a Nettles class, a lot of these guys are really interested in church history, and so I'm not, this isn't indicative of myself, but I just know for a fact there are a lot of really smart people in the room that day, and not me, but the others were, and which made me feel a lot better about what happened to all of us, because Nettles was lecturing, and I just remember thinking, like, I need some help understanding what Edwards was talking about. So Nettles starts talking, and I'm watching him, and I'm listening, and I'm like, man, this is so enlightening. And then somewhere in there, I'm not fast at all. I'm not a good golfer or any of this kind of thing. But, you know, sometimes if you race somebody, first few steps, you're like, I don't think I'm going to embarrass myself. And then a few steps later, you're like, nope, I'm embarrassed, you know? Or you go play golf with somebody that's really good, you know, and you're like, man, look at this. Like, we both parred the first hole, you know, and the next thing you know, they're 10 strokes ahead or whatever. Something happened in there, and at some point, Nettles hit the afterburners, and we all stayed behind. And I just remember my eyes glazed over, and I was like, what is happening right now? And it was, if you ever hear Tom Nettles lecture, it's an amazing thing. He speaks, not like me, where I'm kind of stringing things together. when he starts a sentence, he finishes it, and if you wrote it down, it would sound like a sentence from a book. He's just one of the most articulate and brilliant men I've ever known. And so he's talking, and he's talking, and he's thinking, and you can see him, and then we're all going, you know, drools on the desk or whatever. And then he kind of goes, does that make sense? And nobody says anything. And we're all just staring at him, and he starts laughing. And he says, boys, it's a good thing to think about God. It's a good thing to think about God. And I'll never forget how I did not feel in that moment smaller than Tom Nettles, but I did feel smaller than God, right? God's beyond me. And it is a good thing to think about God. It's a good thing to be challenged. And that's my experience in reading Edwards. I am challenged to look at God and to think about God, and deeply challenged. I think that's Edwards' preaching. I think Edwards' perhaps most important contribution to the history of Christian thought is his teaching and writing on the will and on the affections. Some of you may have heard of an author named John Piper. John Piper was deeply influenced by Jonathan Edwards, and he wrote a book called Desiring God. It's a hugely influential Christian book. It's really become a modern Christian classic that's essentially a reworking of Edwards' thoughts on the affections, what it means to desire God and the importance of the affections. So I want to read to you from Edwards's, for me, hugely influential work called The Religious Affections, because I want you to hear this as well. As in worldly things, worldly affections are very much the spring of men's motion and action. So in religious matters, the spring of their actions is very much religious affections. He that has doctrinal knowledge and speculation only, without affection, never is engaged in the business of religion. Nothing is more manifest, in fact, than that the things of religion take hold of men's souls no further than they affect them. I am bold to assert that there never was any considerable change wrought in the mind or conversation of any person by anything of a religious nature that ever he read, heard, or saw, who had not his affections moved. In a word, there never was anything considerable brought to pass in the heart or life of any man living by the things of religion that had not his heart deeply affected by those things. And I don't think there's a thought that has impacted my preaching more than the fact that we do not obey Jesus apart from our affections being moved toward Jesus. And so you've probably heard me say things like a set of rules is not what's going to make you decide you want to obey Jesus. They're helpful. They're there. God gave us a law on purpose. But what's going to lead you to worship and love and to obey Jesus is if you are inspired by his glory in such a way that you fall in love with him, that you're moved by the glory of God. That's what's going to happen. So you start thinking about my preaching. If you're ever frustrated by my preaching and you're like, man, why in the world is our pastor not just say, here are 10 ways to do better this week, come back next week for more. If you ever wonder why that's the case, it's because you won't do better unless your heart changes, unless your affections are moved toward Jesus. It's a biblical thought, and Edwards helped me see it maybe more than anyone else. And so I just won't give up on trying to paint the most, amplify the beautiful picture of Jesus is in the Bible for you every week, and just pray God will set your heart on fire for him in love, in genuine love and affection. And that's what I hope to see happen. And you can see there in Edwards the way he's really showing, and this is important because this is one of the things that makes the First Great Awakening so effective and so good, and the effects lasted better than the Second Great Awakening. It's because Edwards and others were so emphatic on making sure the head and the heart were connected. Edwards never gave up on doctrine. He never gave up on speaking of the heart. And holding both together is really important. And as you can tell, I mean, it's something I'm extremely passionate about here at our church. Part of what we're trying to do is make sure that we are passionate about knowing doctrine and knowing God, and passionate about loving God and living doctrine as well. So it's, of course, as we all know, just about 1776. And we all know what happens then. And so one of the biggest things to remake religion and Christian history in the world stage is the advent of the United States of America. And it is hugely impactful on the world stage Because it's in many ways the beginning of the end of what we know as this kind of global colonialism, where the great empires of the world start to be remade as America grows into a world power. And there are lots of things, religious liberty, other things, and of course the influence of America in Christianity in the world is a huge factor in modern Christianity as well. So that's what's going on, and I want to mention that as well to kind of give you an idea of where we are in history. So as the Enlightenment comes through, you can see the way that even as revolution is happening, the way people think, revolution is happening in the political order, at the same time God is bringing revival to his people. And even as it seems like Christianity is going by the wayside, you see these great revivals happening. So how about I end with this? The kids are all right. God's got the kids, okay? And even when it seems like things are dire and dark, usually that's when revival is nearly there. And we've heard a lot of talk about the revival that happened at Asbury earlier this year, for which I praise God and thank God. I think we're seeing it happen. But I actually think, my generation, the millennials, experienced a revival. I'm 100% confident that Southern Baptist millennials experienced a revival. I can remember people talking about all the seminaries are going to be empty and we're not going to have students anymore. And we have more seminary students than we've ever had right now, Southern Baptist seminaries. We still don't have enough. We don't have enough pastors to pastor all the churches, but we're getting there. And so I think there was a revival that happened among my generation where there was a big retrieval of the gospel. And a vision of grace that's propelled a lot of people to ministry. And, if you think about it, would anybody in, what expectation would some folks have had that a millennial pastor would be able to come lead this church even, right? That God would even do that. And I always say, well, it's because I didn't know the Lord, and then I heard the gospel and became a Christian, and my heart got gripped by the gospel. And God lit my affections for the gospel, and I just couldn't do anything else. And I can't begin to tell you how many friends and peers I have who tell the exact same story, right? All these people I went to college and seminary with, the same exact story and we were raised in a very secular world with very secular presuppositions, and yet God redeemed us and sent us out into ministry. And so I'll just say it like this: God is at work even when it seems like he couldn't be at work. And I want to encourage everyone to remember that as we go about our lives, as we seek to preach the gospel and spread the gospel here at First Baptist and beyond. Thank y'all. Thank y'all for being here. I love you guys. Thank you for you. Thanks. Bye-bye.